Be it sight, sound, smell, or touch, there's something inside that we need so much. The sight of a touch, or the scent of a sound, or the strength of an oak roots deep in the ground. The wonder of flowers to be covered and then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again. Or to fly to the sun without burning a wing. To lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing. To have all these things in our memories hoard and they use them to help.
Take a ride? To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
There is no doubt about it. One of the coolest, way coolest new shows on television is a show called Medium, which is on NBC. It's the story of a woman whose name is Alison Dubois. Alison Dubois is an average housewife, and not such an average woman in most every other way. She's a real psychic, the real McCoy, and the way they tell her story on television is astoundingly good and refreshing. And Ramona just bought me her book, The Real Story of Alison Dubois. She's in Phoenix and helps out various police agencies, FBI, that kind of thing. And Alison, I really would like to interview you. So would somebody please tell Alison Dubois that it's worth staying up late. She's a real McCoy and she needs to get on coast. So word out, Art would like to interview Alison. Coming up now, this is just as good a segue as one could possibly hope for from where Whitley was going in the last hour, Dr. Bruce Lipton. He received his Ph.D. at the University of Virginia back in 1971, served as associate professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine, where his research on cloned human stem cells provided a radical new understanding of the mechanisms controlling life. Bruce resigned his tenured position, now that's not something you do lightly, to pursue independent research integrating quantum physics with cell biology. He returned to academia as a research scientist at Stanford University School of Medicine to test his hypothesis. From 87 to 92, Bruce's revolutionary studies on the mechanisms of mind-body interactions unify the practices of conventional medicine, complementary medicine, and spiritual healing. His insights made him an internationally sought-after lecturer, and his informative, very informative new book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter, and Miracles, is now available in a moment in person, as I would like to have Alison Dubois. Comes Dr. Bruce Lipton. It's going to be quite a night. Stay right there. Here from, well, actually, I don't know where he's from, is Dr. Bruce Lipton. Doctor, where are you?
California. California and happy.
Well, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
I'm glad to be here. We have some exciting things to talk about.
This whole area is incredibly exciting. I don't know if you follow the program at all, but we've done some things with consciousness that, they scared me. I've been doing this kind of thing for years. In your book, The Biology of Belief, Unleashing the Power of Consciousness, Matter and Miracles, you write about how some sort of scientific epiphany precipitated instantaneous personal transformation in your life. That must have been some very special moment. I know that people, for example, don't just resign tenured positions at big universities unless something really radical happens.
Well, I'll tell you, it was the biggest shock of my life because I was a conventional professor teaching the kind of things medical students get about how biochemistry and genes control life, and teaching the concept essentially the human body is like a machine and that medicine is involved with changing the parts and making it run right and all that. So
yes,
it doesn't leave any room for spirituality and all those other kind of things, which were never actually part of my life.
Right.
And I was working on the stem cells, and people think of all stem cells, that's that recent thing that's just been happening. It's like I actually started working on stem cells, cloning stem cells, back in 1967. So it's almost 40 years ago, in fact. And the biggest surprise of my life were the lessons that those cells showed me. And that particular night was the understanding of actually how cells were controlled. And what was unique about it is this was about 15 years of research that took me away from genes, the belief that genes control life, which everyone else was on that path. And I started recognizing that genes indeed were not controlling life. And when I found out what controlled life, I was shocked into another understanding, another reality. And interesting, I mean, although I got the consciousness hit me right there at that moment, it still took me a bit of time to realize that that we are programmed. And even though I was consciously aware of this new understanding about that we are spiritual entities, that we're not even in the body, and this was through a molecular understanding of how the cell worked, it just floored me because I needed to learn how to put that into my life, not just the awareness of it. So there was a little bit of a lag period, and I think this is important because there's a tendency to think that if we just know something, then you know that's going to change our lives. And this gets into the issue of the consciousness and the programming of patterns and behavior, which came out of this work. And
okay, well, it may have been an epiphany for you, but I'm still not sure that I get it.
Okay, well, let me tell you how it works. It was this, the concept that genes control life. This is what's being taught in schools right now, and it's in every textbook everywhere about the concept, something referred to as genetic determinacy,
right,
which means that the genes that you get at conception are essentially blueprints for the rest of your life, and that
right,
you live your life through this. And what the issue was when I started working on these stem cells, one of the big things that I found out right away is that the character or behavior or traits of the cells change when I put it in one culture environment or change the environment and put them in another environment. They change their behavior, they change their expression, that they were healthy or sick, or they changed into different kinds of cells.
And are you suggesting it's adaptation?
Well, it's basically, it is a dynamic process where life is continuously reading the environment and adjusting the biology to conform to the perception of that environment. So it's not your genes are not your fixed fate. Genes are potentials. What you do with those potentials are based on how you see the environment. And this was the big thing. I mean, after all these years of thinking you want to change your life, you're going to change your genes, and now all of a sudden it says, you want to change your life, you have to understand how you, if you just change your perception of the environment, you can, your whole life can change. So you can talk about, for example, a person who has terminal cancer, and they have bought into the story that this is the end, and this, and their, you know, their life is waning right now, and all of a sudden they just get this belief change that says, no, I'm not going to buy that, I'm not buying that. And they get up and they get out and they exhibit what's called a spontaneous remission. It's like, what happened in this case is they changed something about their perception, belief changed. You can see it in another case, multiple personalities. Multiple personalities in one personality can have blue eyes and then switch to the other personality and have gray eyes.
That's documented.
Yes, and what else is documented is this, is that they can have allergies in one personality, and less than a minute later change personalities And those things that would have caused a severe allergic reaction just a minute before.
Oh, okay, slow up. I really need to understand that this is true. You're saying that a person with multiple personalities, one of them can have blue eyes, but when they switch personalities, actually it's documented, the eyes...
Change color right there in front of your face. And this now this is hard kind of stuff to believe, right?
It is, yes.
And yet it's exciting because it's a pathology... in the sense that they're not in control of it, but it represents an ability that we have the power of changing our expression when we change our perception of life.
Doctor, where can a person do some reading, Bruce, where can a person do some reading to verify that, for example?
Okay, there's an organization of dissociation. I'll get it, and then we can post it on the line, okay? There's a an organization for dissociation studies, dissociation being people separating from their personality and acquiring other personalities. There's a big organization that studies this, and there's data to all this effect. Even, you know, the story, The Three Faces of Eve, I think that movie that came out, do you remember something like
that? Yes,
Well, I met that woman, and she's actually one of the first ones that she had a severe allergy to strawberries that caused her to get hives in one of her personalities, and when she changed personality, that strawberry, allergy didn't affect her.
That I believe. Let's go back for a second to spontaneous remissions. Now, I know that's true. That happens.
Yes.
I don't know how frequently. I think it's fairly rare.
But it happens to which people express it. This is important. What is uniform about those that express it versus that don't?
What is? I assume that you looked at studies of spontaneous remissions. How many have there been?
The number's in thousands, but in the sense that the problem is that when you try to document it, then there's a take back where they say, well, the original diagnosis wasn't necessarily correct all of a sudden. And this is the issue because it doesn't conform to an understanding that medicine likes to play with, except they're very aware of it. It's called the placebo effect. And what it really represents is, what is the placebo effect? It's an ability to heal yourself based on the belief that whatever you're doing at that moment is something that will effectively heal you.
Yes, as long as you believe, it will work.
Yes, and people should know this as well. There's an equal and opposite effect called the nocebo effect. And that's the one that says if you are told that you can't do something about it or that it's, you know, it's too late.
I'm sorry, son, you have a brain tumor. You have 6 months. It's irreversible and inoperable.
That belief system itself will promote that situation. And it's a very important understanding because it says, look, placebo, nocebo, it's the same concept. It's basically, it says what you believe and your perceptions will change the biology that you're expressing. And this is actually a new understanding, and it's not that new. In fact, science has actually been publishing information about how this mechanism occurs since 1990. And it's a new understanding in the sense that it's not in the textbook. It's been in the leading-edge research for at least the last 15 years, and it's a concept called epigenetic control. And what does that mean? Well, genetic control is what we were talking about before. Genes control life.
But doesn't this leave a doctor who buys into what you're saying right now in a terrible position? Because if he tells a patient he's got an inoperable fatal tumor, then he has just dispensed the piece of information that's going to kill that person.
At exactly the same time, it's not a helpful situation, and it's been an issue because when you talk to doctors, their programming is not to give false hope. And so the significance about this is it's an important program because if you don't give false hope, meaning it's hope that you don't have anything you can, you know, there's no evidence for. So
yes.
I'm going to tell you something could happen here, but I don't have any evidence. They call that false hope. So the significance is you take away from their arsenal of healing abilities, you take away the ability of suggestion that they could influence the person because the idea was they don't want to be held liable for anything. And as a result, it's like, okay, this is what you have. And it's an issue of, it's an unfortunate issue of legal issues and medical issues intermixing right there. It's very difficult because a doctor is really obliged not to offer something that he can't scientifically attest to.
But if, in fact, the human mind is capable of reversing the otherwise scientifically thought to be irreversible, then there's an obligation on the part of the healer who's taken an oath to do the very best he can to include this. This is going to be very hard, though, to get into traditional scientific literature. It's just, and medical literature.
It's actually, they're trying to wean it out of the literature right now. The drug companies are trying to remove studies of placebos.
Yeah.
And the reason is because it contaminates their studies. Many of their drugs are no better than placebos. Prozac is scientifically not really of any value above a sugar pill. And that is a scientific fact that the federal government, this psychologist, Irwin Kirsch at the University of Connecticut, he had to actually sue the government's Freedom of Information Act to get the test results on these drugs. And it's found out that he's reported a number of papers on it, that the fact is that that Prozac and Zoloft, those kind of drugs, are no better than a placebo. And it's very hard because you can get those people who take this drug that will swear on their lives
that
this is what did it.
Oh, yes.
And yet, of course, and it's like, oh, well, I'm happy that happened. There are a lot of people that could have sworn before that Laetril cured their cancer. And it did, but it wasn't really through the Laetril. It was that they took it with the belief that this was the most fantastic cancer cure ever. And they started to do this. So the issue is, I mean, how can you do this? And what we're talking about seems like magic. It's like, if I change my belief or perception of what I see, I change my biology, and the answer is through the new understanding called epigenetic control. And the word epi is key here because that prefix epi means above. So the word, and this is a new area of study.
Above genetic control.
That's exactly what it says. And what it represents is this. We used to think genes were these autonomous units. You walk down the street, and all of a sudden, a gene will say, well, it's time for cancer or something. A gene gave you cancer, and
we gave
all this credit and power to genes. And here's a simple truth. A gene is a blueprint. It is exactly that. What it means is this. The body is made out of proteins. These are very complex molecules. That the complexity needs a blueprint to make them. The gene is a linear string, which is a blueprint, to make these proteins. And why that's important is this. Go to an architect's office, and he's working on a blueprint on his desk. Stand behind him and ask him, is that blueprint on or off? And he'll look at you, what do you mean it's on or off? Well, you talk about a gene being on or off, and the reality is, boy, have we made a big mistake. The fact is, as the contractor would tell you, the blueprint's not on or off. It's whether I read the blueprint or I don't read the blueprint that makes all the difference. And that's what medicine is now beginning to realize, is that the genes don't turn on and off. It's whether the cell reads the genes or the cell doesn't read the gene. And all of a sudden, then you have to back up and say, yeah, but then who's in charge of what the cell reads?
Right. And the answer to that?
The skin or membrane of the cell, which is in sense, in human embryology, our brain and our nervous system is derived from the skin as well. And and the skin, you say, well, the skin is the brain. And the answer is, of course, if you think about it, it's the interface between the organism and the environment. So one side of the skin is reading the outside world. The other side of the skin is reading the inside world. And by processing that information, the skin can adjust the biology to meet the needs of the environment.
I thought the skin, for example, was simply providing a signal to the brain, kind of like an input of information.
Yeah, in embryology, those that have out there may have heard the words. In embryology, you start with a single egg, you fertilize it, it forms a ball of cells, and the next stage is called a gastrulation, which it's a funny word, but it really means that the embryo, the cells, have stratified into three layers, an outer layer, a middle layer, and an inner layer. These layers are called, right in sequence, the outer layer ectoderm, the middle layer mesoderm, and the inner layer endoderm. Derm means germ layer. So ecto means outer. So the outer layer of the embryo, there's three layers. The outer layer is called ectoderm. Each one of these germ layers is responsible for providing very specific organs or tissues of the body.
Right.
The ectoderm only provides for two things. The skin and the central nervous system. The central nervous system is formed from the back of the embryo. The skin of the back turns in and forms what is called a neural tube, and that becomes the spinal cord in the brain.
Hmm.
And so what was the point? Well, the cell skin is the brain. the human skin, the derivative of the skin from the back, actually becomes the brain itself. And it says the same thing, and this is a very important point, is that when I tell students this, when I was teaching in medical school, they see themselves, we each see ourselves, we look in the mirror as this singular entity, a single person. I look in the mirror, I see Bruce right there, and I say, well, that's one thing. And the reality is, that is a misinterpretation for this reason. If I would shrink you down to the size of a cell, you would see that you are actually made out of living units. The living things that make you are the cells. You are a community of cells. In fact, maybe up to 50 trillion cells in that community. What's the point? It's like, well, you look at yourself as a singular thing, but in truth, you're a harmonious, when you're healthy, community of 50 trillion cells interacting together with a just like a metropolis. I mean, they exchange food and money and energy.
So so we're sort of a totality of brain. Is,
yeah.
Okay. All right. Dr. Bruce Lipton is my guest from the high desert in the middle of the night. Lots to be learned this night about consciousness and the nature of what we really are. We tend to think of ourselves in such a separate way, our skin, all the rest of us, and our brain. That's all separate, right? Wrong.
Code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from East of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From West of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
My guest is Dr. Bruce Lipton, who essentially walked away from a tenured career at a major university. You just don't do that after having an epiphany about the nature of us. He had been doing cloning on human cells. Oh, well, we need to ask about that as well, which we will in a moment. My wife during the break said, well, then, if we really are all of that, when we get a really terrible sunburn, haven't we just, well, haven't we damaged our brains? Since Dr. Lipton was involved actually in cloning human stem cells, it's an irresistible question to take you back to that research doctor and ask you about the advisability of the race we have going on right now with cloning, and eventually, I suppose, with genetic tampering and changing, and oh, we seem on the precipice of this incredible revolution. Do you think that we're wholly on a wise course here?
Absolutely not. And in fact, it's real interesting in this regard, because all of us have stem cells in us right now. And there's an interesting, like, you know, philosophical point, if you think about it, is that if we all have stem cells, then why is it, you know, why is it that the pharmaceutical industry, for example, has to identify how to make those stem cells work? Almost like a joke, like God gave us stem cells, but didn't give us a way to use them. Mm. The fact is we have stem cells, and they are quite usable in our system. And yet it's based on perception of the system, what those stem cells, what's going to become of them. It's just like I said, I start with stem cells, I put them in this environment, they form this, I put them in another environment, they form something completely different, and then you start to realize it's the environment that was controlling the development of those stem cells. And in our world, in our belief system, there's this tendency to believe that that we are not like a renewing kind of organism, that we can't repair and replace ourselves. So that's a belief. And yet, unfortunately, that perception gets in the way of the operation of the stem cells, and prevents us from healing ourselves, because we have a tendency to believe that we can heal ourselves.
But we can.
Yes, we can, and amazing things happen, and then we call them miracles, and people try, again, these are exceptions to the rule, and sort of like, look, Roger Bannister was the first guy to run the 4-minute mile. He was the exception to the rule, but once he did it, other people saw that they could be exceptions to the rule and change, and many, many people were able to run a 4-minute mile after he did it once. And
that's true.
Similar kind of thing here. We have to recognize that we have abilities that have been essentially programmed out of us regarding our own ability to heal ourselves. I mean, there were you know, 1 million years of humans before there were doctors, and they managed themselves very well. And the fact is we have bought into a perception that we are frail, that we live in a world and everything is out there to get us.
Well, are you suggesting the science of stem cell research, eventually replacement, I guess, is a sort of a fraud? In other words, it's not the active ingredient in the cure?
No, I really, it's not so much a fraud, it's a misdirection, because it's our belief system that has propagated us to think that these are just mechanical devices, and you throw in the right chemical, and this mechanical device is going to do a miracle for you. When in reality, if they come up with a chemical that controls those stem cells, guess what? It must match a chemical we already have in our body, because if God gave us the stem cells, it wasn't without the key to use them. And so the fact is, we actually have to recognize that it is within ourselves, this ability to heal ourselves. And it's been something that we've been programmed out of. And, it's based on perception. Just think about it, that an infant is born with a doctor that goes to the doctor for checkups on its health all the time. During its young period, anytime it gets sick, the information is, well, if you're sick, I have to take you to the doctor. And if we get around to understanding this new understanding of epigenetics, how our perceptions control our biology, and you start to see a program that a child receives when it's young that says, when it's sick, it's not up to itself to heal itself. Then you have to take it to some specialist to heal it. And the reality is then that becomes a perception, and then that is then what controls the healing. And in fact, it's interesting how many people have that perception, and actually when they get sick, on the way to the doctor, they already start to get better. Because once you engage the steps that you've put in the way of healing, then the healing process can begin again.
Boy, are you right about that. Boy, are you ever right about that. What you just said, I had a pretty bad flu not too long ago, and it just went, you know, the temperature went on and on and on and on. And after so many days of having a very high temperature, I said to my wife, okay, that's it. We're going to the hospital. So we get in the car, and we've got about an hour drive from here in Pahrump, Nevada, to Las Vegas, to the hospital where I went. And I'm telling you right now, doctor, by the time I got there, my temperature had fallen.
Mm-hmm.
I was feeling better for the first time in days and days and days. And this is all in the one, you know, from that moment, that instant of decision to go ahead and go to the doctor, to the hour drive to get in there, it was almost like, why was I there?
Absolutely, and we have these powers, and it's And it's funny because we live in a world where we've been taught that these powers don't exist. And since the biology, which that epiphany really led me to, is the nature that every cell is, and technically every cell is a programmable chip, and that the human body is an integration of 50 trillion chips, and that the programmer is not inside the cell. Huh. And this is the part that blew me away, because I realized our identity isn't in the cell. It plays to the cell. And this became part of the epiphany of how that membrane works. And that was this night of transformation where I realized, oh, my God, all those years I was teaching these students about genetic control, and they're still getting the same message. And it is now, but well, it's been 20 or more years since I caught on to it, but conventional science in the last 10 years has fully recognized this, and yet it's not coming out to the mainstream very quickly, because an interesting loophole is that when people know this, then they're in power of their own health, and there's a lot of interest that are not interested in seeing that happen.
Huh. And I'm sure the drug companies are not all that interested in seeing something
Absolutely.
Like this breaking loose.
They make money on selling pills. If you could heal yourself with energy and you can't sell the energy, then they're not interested in promoting that. And it's an important understanding, because I have to, you know, really stand here and say, look, medicine is getting a bad rap because it's not living up to whatever it's been promising. And there's a fact that is so, it irritates me so much, because this fact is so important and not revealed, and that is that the leading cause of death in the United States today is the medical profession, and it's not, and it's a fact by numbers. I mean, I could give you Gary Null's website. He has an article, Death by Medicine, with all the statistics, and the fact is the AMA said they were third in the leading cause of death themselves, so the medical profession admitted to being third leading cause of death, and they did it with estimates. And then what Gary Null did, he said, rather than the estimates, let me just get the real numbers and let me know what the numbers say. And the numbers were staggering. 780,000 people die from medical intervention, not because of the sickness they came with, but because of the consequence of the intervention. And then all of a sudden it's like, and now this is my point, if there's a soapbox, please, it's not the medical doctor's fault. It's not their fault at all, because it's the academic fault, and it's the pharmaceutical industry's fault.
Nor, by the way, is it necessarily saying that physicians are unneeded. People still fall down, break bones.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, listen, physicians do this. There's nobody better in the entire world than, if you have trauma, the medical profession is the place to go. You want to fix something, cut it out, replace it, you know, tie it up. These guys do miracles, okay? But when you want to get down to the mechanisms of why something happened, why do we have a cancer? What causes Alzheimer's? How come diabetes is, this big issue? Well, these aren't trauma. These are other things. And here's the problem. Medicine knows the body as a physical device, a mechanical device, and can treat it like a repair person says, oh, you know, I got to take out the exhaust pipe, put a new pipe in. You know, I have to put a new bypass around this carburetor in right here like this. That's easy to do, but when it comes to understanding the mechanics of how it works, they don't really have an understanding, because they're still being taught the concept that genes control life. And let's straighten this out for the audience right now, a simple point. If genes control life, which is the belief, and the genes are in the nucleus of the cell, which is this large organelle inside a cell, and genes control life, then there's a simple fact. If you take the genes out and throw them away, there's no control left, and life should stop. And this process is called enucleation, and I actually did this with my clone cells, is I destroy the DNA. It's not working at all. It's done. And what happens is the cells still go on and live and still make all the responses that they would.
Oh, no, that's fascinating. You destroyed the DNA in cells.
Yes.
Just to see what would happen. And you're suggesting nothing happened.
Well, it didn't change their behavior. I can tell you exactly what happened at some point. And it's a funny thing about it, because we've been up to now saying that the genes control the cell, as if the genes are the brain of the cell. In fact, many textbooks actually say that. And the fact is, if you take the brain out of an organism and throw it away, by definition, that organism's going to die.
Yes.
And we buy that, but it turns out the genes and the nucleus, it's not the brain, It's the gonad of the cell. It's reproduction. It doesn't have an idea in the world what needs to be turned on and off. The genes are not intelligent, and we've given them this intelligence. So basically it says, well, what happens when you take the genes out and throw it away? And the answer is, at some point, the cell will die because it was using those genes, those blueprints, to replace the building blocks of the machinery of the cell. If I throw away the genes, there's a point where all of a sudden I'll need a protein to do a function, and I won't have the blueprint available, and then at some point, that's when the cell will stop.
All right, this is going to seem a little off track, or maybe it's not. There was this crazy story that I read a few years ago. I've got it in front of me right now, called Mike the Headless Chicken.
Yes.
Now, this chicken had its head cut off.
Mm-hmm.
Only trouble, this is pretty horrible stuff. It didn't die, and the owner kept feeding it by pouring stuff down its headless neck. I swear to God, this is true.
Yeah.
By pouring food down its headless neck.
Yeah.
And in every other way, this chicken went on to lead a normal, as much as you can without a head, normal life. It's not possible, only it actually happened.
I'll tell you, here's the truth about yourself. I'll tell you what. We could take your digestive tract. I cut it from your mouth out all the way down to the stomach, the guts, all the way down to the rectum. I take it out. If you put it on a table, stick a piece of food in one end, and it will digest the food and eliminate the waste at the other end. It's the controls are built into its own self so that the process of putting food in will engage all the next steps, and that we now know that things like walking and standing, a lot of that has to do with actual spinal cord information.
Apparently so, which goes back to the brain is sort of everywhere contention, right?
Every cell has a brain. And that's the important thing, and that in your community of cells, that there's a distribution of the workload. I mean, that's what the nature of a community is, to share awareness. That's why the first 3 billion years of life on this planet, there was 3 billion years of living things. You know what? They were all single cells. They were like yeast and bacteria and amoebas and some paramecia and algae.
So then, Doctor, in this headless chicken,
yes,
the spinal cord left intact and the rest of the chicken was enough for this chicken to function normally as a chicken without a head.
As long as he put the food in there and the chicken didn't have to do any consideration about what it had to do, the rest of it is a mechanical device. It's sort of like people that get put on life support systems. Their brain's not working. The rest, as long as you feed it, the body will continue to run. There's an intelligence throughout the entire body. Every cell is intelligent. That was the nature of like the stem cell research. It's like, it's interesting. I would take stem cells from muscular dystrophy patients, put them in the tissue culture, and you know what? They grew better in the tissue culture than they did in the patient. And the reason was, they necessarily weren't having the problem. It was the environment inside the patient that was toxic.
Wow.
And so it's a whole new understanding, and it's very, very important because it says, look, we are not victims of genes. We can rewrite which genes that we use on a day-by-day, minute-by-minute basis. It's a way of staying alive in a dynamic world, is the ability to change which genes are being read at any time in order so your biology will meet the demands of that world.
So if you were diagnosed with, I don't know, Alzheimer's, for example, how would you proceed with the understanding that you have and that diagnosis in your hand? How would you proceed?
The first thing I would try to find out is where's the cause of the problem. The Alzheimer's, let's say, is actually the symptom of the problem. That's the consequence of something going wrong. Not it itself is the problem. It is the consequence. Now, the issue is, where do things go wrong? Well, you could have something physical go wrong, like trauma could cause a problem. You know, you blunt force trauma is certainly going to interfere with the nervous system and stuff like that.
Yes, but that kind of thing aside.
Yeah, the main thing that we now know is the concept called autosuggestion. Meaning, it's also psychoneuroimmunology is another example of that. Meaning, at some point, we used to ascribe all the control to something within the cell, the genes, and now the control is being sent up the line, up to the interpretation of the nervous system, and so the genes are more or less obedient to the central nervous system, which makes sense for this reason. Every cell is intelligent. Every cell, I could take it out of your body, put them in a tissue culture dish, they'll grow, they'll be happy, they'll multiply and all this kind of stuff. And every cell is independently looking at the world and responding to, you know, whatever it has to do to adjust its biology to stay alive.
All right, but once again, here you are with Alzheimer's. I'm asking how you personally would proceed.
Okay, and the thing is, I'd have to go back and find out what kind of belief system would I be involved with that would support this process. And I'll give you a couple of examples, because even knowing people that personally, that were very dear to me that ended up with this, and I could see right away what one of the big issues, there are two main issues. One is that when people get cut off and their lives are sort of like they're getting older, they lose social contacts. It has been demonstrated that this loss of social contact is one of the primary causes of senile dementia, including Alzheimer's. Basically, it says the brain is like any other tissue organ system in the body. The more you use it, the more it develops. The less you use it, it will automatically dismantle itself because the biology is efficient. It just says, if you use it, then I'm going to keep it here. And if you're not going to use it, then we're taking it apart because we're not maintaining it for a trophy, the body, that is. So the body will adjust to its use. And they now find, as I said, and these are references that can be off my website, that people can get off the website about this, is that it now recognizes that the vast majority of senile dementia is due to lack of use of the brain.
Otherwise,
that's one thing right
atrophy,
there.
Right?
Atrophy of the brain, because you lose your contacts, you lose your community of people, and then you start to go internally more at that point, and then your skills start to dismantle themselves. That's one thing. And then there's a pathological thing that could also cause, and that is people who are being leaned on by so many other people, like, you know, they're in demand to keep the show running, let's say.
Yes.
And the pressure is like so much that the only way out is to disconnect. And so that there would be how can a thought cause that? And the answer is, let me alone. and this is really important, because the thoughts that we have in our head are actually directives that are being sent to the cell. So you might sit there at the stoplight and hear these thoughts running in your head like it's entertaining your head. Well, in one sense, they may be. In the other sense, you have to recognize this. All those thoughts are being broadcast to 50 trillion cells. And these cells are who you are. This is the collective community. Their collective consciousness is our consciousness and the reality. So we're living in this community, and our central voice, meaning our central nervous system, is sort of like the government talking to the cells. And psychologists tell us 70% or more of those thoughts in your head while you're at that light are negative and redundant.
All right. Doctor, hold it right there. So what I'm interested in is, if you had such a diagnosis, what precise real steps would you begin to take to reverse it? Or would it begin to reverse the moment you decided you were going to reverse it? Fascinating stuff. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.